We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
Welcome to Dad's on the Air for Tuesday, December 29, 2009. Been very, very wet here in Sydney, very wet and cold over the last few days, normally very hot. Christmas, but not this year. Put a bit of a dampener on all the global warming thing, didn't it? It was really cold. Miracles do happen at this time of year. My son put petrol in the car last night. My teenage son.
Oh, well, there you go. Perhaps we should nominate him for sainthood.
Oh, we should. Day after day. You can take the car, but just put some petrol in it because it's always empty.
There you go.
I'm sure parents with teenage children would around the country would probably relate, or maybe they've got saints and I don't, or whatever the story. A bit lonely in here today. We've got Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com. Who's at the board?
You have indeed, John. Good morning.
Myself, John Stapleton, and the rest of the crew are holidaying, slack asses.
Yeah, off somewhere enjoying sun, no doubt, and drinking margaritas in front of the swimming pool. Rock and pop, he'll be into that, I'm sure.
Rock and pops up in the country.
Yes, indeed.
Cheerio. Now, we're going to have Barry Williams on from Loan Farmers Association shortly. He'll be talking about, well, this time of year, and also about family law reform in Australia, which has gone sadly awry. The Rudd government's holding numerous inquiries into family law, none of which have done anything or gone out of their way to consult fathers or fathers groups in any way. It's a real sort of backlash against the progressive reforms that the previous government introduced to encourage fathers into their lives after divorce, into the lives of their children after divorce.
And whoever would have thought we were calling John Howard's government progressive? Now they're progressive.
On this one, issue, certainly was. And there's been a real backlash against from the ancient regime propped up by the Labor government.
The feminists.
Which created the family court in the first place all those sorry years ago. There's a number of stories around. Here's one bound to get under most people's collars.
Indeed. Under the heading, $1 billion in deadbeat debt. Sue Dunleavy, exclusive, the word above, just above her name there, in blueprint in this morning's Telegraph. She writes, deadbeat parents owe their children more than $1 billion despite a crackdown on mums and dads who don't pay child support. The child support debt has grown by 12.8% despite a 20% increase in child support agency staff and a $900 million funding boost to help the agency improve the system. What do you think about that, John? $900 million to the child support agency to help them improve their system of ringing.
Well, if there was any justice in the land, that agency would have been abolished long ago. On the front of our website, www.dadsontheair, beautifully redesigned by Greg Andreessen. Thank you so much. That's dadsontheair.net, not our old site. The old .com site is long gone. It's www.dadsontheair.net. You can listen to all our last shows.
Absolutely.
And so on and so forth. Now, we have a counter on that website where we estimate the approximate death toll of the agency. That is the number of their clients that die each day. This began quite, there's a lot of history to this argument over what is the death rate of child support payers. There's claims that people in the divorce age bracket dominate the suicide statistics. And we've always argued that the male suicide statistics, which are very high in this country, are only the beginning of the story. Now, it was claimed quite some years ago by a number of the fathers' groups in Australia that about 3 clients of the agency were dying each day, and they were fathers' groups, and we set out to investigate this over the years. Now, we estimate that far from just being 3 clients of the agency dying each day, that it's approximately 12 a day.
12. That's a big number.
It's a big number. We estimate that over 9,000, I'll just get the exact figure here, 9,180 clients of the Child Support Agency of Australia have died since Kevin Rudd became Prime Minister. There are no inquiries, no investigations. The Child Support Agency agency traditionally has refused to show up at inquests claiming privacy, so that even when a magistrate has requested specifically that the child support agency be present and that the documentation would clearly indicate that the CSA was closely involved in these men's lives and in their deaths, they refuse to show up to face the court process. It's a desperate need in this country for a major inquiry into the CSA and its impacts on the lifestyles and the health of both men and women and children.
Absolutely.
It was first invented, the Bolsheviks in Russia were the first people to invent child support agencies, and they were there because of the Bolshevik. They saw the traditional nuclear family as the last sort of bulwark against the state, and they were determined to overthrow that. But of course, you were then left with how do you support children, and so thus were born child support agencies.
Mm.
They were introduced by left-wing academics right around the Western world in the 80s, and they have been an absolute fiasco ever since. You don't have to look very far to find significant documentation from this agency showing how they've destroyed people's lives, destroyed businesses. In this country, the government proudly announces every now and then that X number of fathers have been blocked from leaving Australia. These are legitimate financial refugees who cannot make a go of it in Australia and are going to somewhere like Bahrain where they can actually cobble together a living. And they block them from leaving the airport. And often there are cases where they're going overseas to where they can make some money to support their families, but they can't leave as a result of it. All sorts of negative results of what was essentially, I was going to say, well-intentioned in the beginning, but it was never well-intentioned. It was introduced when Bob Hawke was around, and he was claiming that no child would live in poverty, and then it was introduced by his left-wing social affairs minister, Brian Howe.
Anyway, getting back to Sue Dunleavy's article here in this morning's Telegraph, just cut you off a little bit there, prune you. The government's finance watchdog, the Auditor General, was highly critical of the Child Support Agency in a new report which revealed almost 400,000 parents are not getting proper child support. 400,000. What do you think of that number? Do you think there's any credibility?
They claim this massive debt, this is propaganda exercised by the agency, they claim this debt, they count debt from dead fathers. Now, they know it's a very live issue.
How to get money
out of it. It's a very live issue in the community, and you've only got to talk to grieving parents of fathers who've died, and it's a very, very live issue in the community, and yet they count that debt. Someone dies allegedly owing $40,000. That is in that figure that they're claiming is owed. Well, how outrageous is that?
From when? But from how far back? Like if they
1989, when it was created.
Wow. So all of that money is just building up, and a lot of it's just
the fantasy figures.
Okay. Well, Sue Dunleavy goes on to say that was because the income estimates provided had not been checked against tax data. So they're even saying, well, they're giving another reason for it. The agency, she goes on to write, the agency received extra money in the May 2009 budget. However, the Auditor General said only 41.5% of child support assessments were accurate. And it said it could not tell if the government met its target of saving $43 million by changing the way family tax benefit was paid to separated parents because savings resulting from compliance measures are not assessed by departments. So that's
amazing.
That's a
litany. We're going to save all this money by reforming the system. Oh, P.S., we don't bother to count it.
Yeah.
Oh, they're mind-boggling, mind-boggling.
That is amazing.
On that figure of 9,180, the Child Support Agency has a legal affairs department, well over 100 lawyers sitting in there mopping up your taxes. They could issue a cease and desist notice at any time. We're a community radio station. We have all the normal legal and social responsibilities of any other community radio program, and yet no such notice has ever been received. That figure is not far from the truth and could well be an underestimate. It is really a major concern, the impact this appalling agency and these figures, the same figures that were used in Russia all those years ago, are perpetrated on fathers in Australia today.
Well, Sue Dunleavy goes on to say the child support reforms introduced during 2006 were the biggest ever change to the system. The changes meant fathers on welfare and the lowest incomes had their child support payments rise from $260 per year to $320 a year. 3,000 wealthy fathers had their child support payments drop by more than $6,000 a year. Fathers who cared for their children one night a week also had their child support obligations drop. Well, that all sounds pretty ridiculous. That's, you know, taking from the poor and giving to the rich.
Well, it's a very selective use of the stats. It really is, no offence to Sue Dunleavy, but it is a very selective use of the statistics, and it has highlighted what some people saw as the negative consequences of these reforms. Increasing welfare payments, well, it was all just a roundabout, really. I mean, even if you're unemployed, you're expected to pay $5, and if you are caring for your children a certain amount of time. Everyone knows that even if you've got your kid a couple of days a week only, you have to provide a bedroom and everything else, and it's expensive. Everyone knows that there are a lot of costs associated with having your child, even if, very unfortunately, you don't have them at least half the time. And just to take these sort of statistics and make out that it's all been bad is wrong. It was it was seen by many as a much fairer system, and people were and still are paying outrageous sums of child support. And it's a false system because a lot of women expect this is going to solve all their financial problems. It doesn't. A lot of it is Social Security clawback.
Of course it is.
People are just,
No, it's ridiculous. It's a way of encouraging women to destroy their families.
That's what's happening. It's a massive, massive bureaucracy.
Well, anyway, the article goes on to say the auditor said the Child Support Agency was aware the changes were likely to result in an increase in the number of people not paying full child support, and it got extra money and staff to head off the problem. However, this was not enough to head off a big increase in debt. The audit report said, so the amount of money that's increasing as more people, like you say, die and the debt just accumulates, well, of course it's going to increase. Anyway, she finishes by saying the agency has been testing new ways of cracking down on debt, including using private detectives to spy on dads who claim low incomes but get paid large amounts in cash. The audit found it cost $30,000 per case to employ private detectives to chase down deadbeat dads. The most successful.
That costs an absolute fortune. Wouldn't it be much easier?
$30,000 per
wouldn't
person.
It be so much easier, and everyone would be so much happier if they encouraged shared parenting? The inquiries show that if the dads see their kids a substantial amount of the time, they're more than happy to pay for them. They want to do the right things by their children. It's an absolutely primary impulse amongst dads. They just to protect and love their children. Absolutely fundamental, and yet these people step in and turn you into a criminal.
Yeah, when you've done nothing wrong, that's absolutely it. You lose all your basic human rights. They can spy on you. They can take your money. It's just ridiculous.
They can block you leaving the country.
Exactly right. Confiscate your assets. I mean, it's incredible. Kick you out of your home. Mm. You know, everything they want. Anyway, the last sentence. We'll get in the last sentence from Sue Dunleavy. Her wonderful article here entitled $1 Billion in Deadbeat Debt. She writes, finally, the most successful debt reduction program was one that seized tax returns to repay child support debt. What do you think of that, seizing
it's
tax returns?
It's a stupid, punitive tone.
Yeah.
Introduce shared parenting and a lot of these problems would evaporate and a lot of these bureaucrats would be out of a job. Yeehaw.
Well, perhaps we better go to a song.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. Your love. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever I want.
An article here by...
Hang on, I think we've got Barry Williams on the line. With a bit of luck. Are you there, Barry? Are you there? We're talking with Barry Williams from Loan Fathers Association. Are you there, Barry?
Yeah, yes, John.
Oh, good. Okay. Sorry, we've been having a bit of trouble with the buttons here. Yeah, there you are. Well, best of the year, best of the season to you.
Best to you, mate, and all your listeners too.
All right. For anyone who doesn't know, Barry Williams is the grandfather, basically, of the fatherhood movement in Australia. He founded Loan Fathers. What year was it?
1972.
Oh, dear. The party was just beginning for some. Dear, oh, dear. You were a single dad all those years ago.
Yep.
Goodness gracious.
Still a single dad.
Still a single dad, even if they're all adults.
That's right, bud.
At least they put petrol in the car if they borrow it, do they?
Yeah.
Good. Look, what do you make of what's been happening through 2009 in the whole arena of family law and father's issues?
Well, mate, even though things are getting better, I'm still disappointed. I'm disappointed. I'm quite happy with the way the child support scheme starting to, under a shared incomes basis, is starting to work. But the people running it, there's a few problems still there with some of the people with their ideas and ideals about, you know, they know what's best in that. But I'm very disappointed with the family, with the access and stuff like that, because access under the 2006 laws was supposed to be made easy. But I've got to tell you, even though I'm up in Nambucca Heads at the moment, my mobile hasn't stopped with blokes who just can't see their kids. They've got court orders. They've been accused by their ex of sexually assaulting 2-year-old and 3-year-old daughters just because these blokes have got access time with their kids and the mum don't want to let them have it. One that shocked me most of all, John, is that one bloke had got to court and proved he was innocent, and the court said it never ever happened, and the doctor said it never ever happened, yet the court still denied him. They said, well, the mother's still so vicious towards you that she keeps accusing you, so we have to stop you seeing your child. Now, we're supposed
I've heard of those cases, quite a few of them.
Civil country and have human rights and civil liberties. Well, I've made it quite clear that I'm writing to every head of every Commonwealth country to tell them not to take notice to Australia on its human rights and civil liberties when they're preaching to other countries, because they're breaking them here every day in the bloody courts.
It's too true, isn't it? Yeah.
Taking ropes from around blokes' necks and trying to stop them from suiciding over this crap, and yet they just don't do nothing, you know. You can't get to court. It takes you months and months and sometimes years to get to court. In the meantime, you don't see your children.
And then the status quo is set in, and if the status quo suits the...
John, Australia preaches we put the children first. It's that we look at the children's rights. Well, they're not looking at the children's rights at all. The children's rights is to have meaningful contact with both parents. If both parents are good parents and not a threat to the children. Most of these guys, and I say most of them, are innocent. Mm. They're victims of this bloody system.
99%?
I would say close to... I would go and say at least 89% of them are, yeah.
Yeah. What do you do? What do you say to these blokes, many of whom spend, of course, vast amounts of money fighting in the legal system?
Yeah.
What do you say to these
blokes? Well, I just say don't give up. Look, Howard, with all due respect to John Howard, he did the right thing. He said children have to have more time with their dads, and not just every second weekend and after school holidays. It had to be days through the week and everything. And that law was enforced in, and I'm very proud to say that my organisation played one of the main parts in getting that done. But the courts are just overruling it. The magistrates are a law under their own. You know what one magistrate told me? He said it doesn't matter if a father's accused of sexually abusing his young daughter. If the mother keeps insisting that it happened, even though the father's been cleared of any malice, that we'll have to take a decision in the end and not let the father see the child.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe it.
Really common. So they're rewarded for the most vile behaviour of accusing someone, you know, the worst possible crimes, and they're just blatantly rewarded for it.
Overall, with the shared care laws, mate, I've got to be honest, we are getting very positive results of those who got it.
Mm.
And a lot of guys, more guys, I know guys that never seen their kids before, were having trouble seeing their kids, you know, and they've gone to the mediation and they've got shared care, and a lot of them, you wouldn't think they'd have never got them. So what I want to say to people, don't give up. If you don't win the first time, appeal and go back again.
Really? All of which costs an awful lot of time, money, emotional energy.
No. If you can't afford a solicitor, go and do it yourself, but always put the children first. If you put the children first and stand up and say, look, it's in the best interest of the child that the child has two parents to grow up.
Hmm.
We both married and we both had children. We divorced each other, but the children never divorced either of us, and it's enforced it as a child's natural right to have the contact. not yours, because they don't listen to you when you say yours, even though it is your right to. You got to put the child first. And I've been telling lots of blokes that, and honestly, they've got back to me, and a lot of them have won their case.
Really? Without a lawyer?
Without a lawyer. Because the lawyers, mate, they're all their interest is the bloody money that comes out of your pocket, you know.
Oh, so many blokes say that their lawyers might as well have been acting for their ex-wife.
Yeah, but there is good lawyers out there too. I'm not putting them all in the hard basket, but there's a lot of them are just not interested. A lot of lawyers probably don't know any more than you know yourself as of your own rights, you know.
I personally don't think it should have ever been handed into the legal domain, that it really is not an area for lawyers, and that the old saying, there's no situation that can't be made worse by a lawyer, is pretty true of separation, you know, the couples.
Well, mate, the Federal Magistrates Court was set up to solve all these problems, and for a while they're doing a great job. But now I question the Federal Magistrates Court, and I'm actually writing to John Pusco, the chief magistrate of the Federal Magistrates, and telling him that half his magistrates are not doing the right thing, you know? I was shocked when this magistrate told me the other day what I told you. He said that doesn't matter if the mother keeps making the accusations, we have to take it if it's true.
And how on earth does it benefit a child to cave into or reinforce the delusions or the vicious behaviour of an individual, in this case the mother? How does that benefit a kid? And how does it benefit a kid to be denied contact with their father? How does that benefit them?
It doesn't matter. They don't care, mate. They don't care. They go home and they've got their children, most of them, and half of them have never been through the system.
I
blame a lot of it on this child protection unit they've got set up in New South Wales and care and ACT and that. Some of these young women making decisions to take children away from dads and that. I've seen it myself. A 19 and 20-year-old, never been married, never had children himself, learnt from this appearance out of a book. They've never, ever, you know, should ever be able to make that decision.
And they're fresh out of gender studies courses and outraged about, you know, everything. Angry young women.
Yeah.
Dear.
I would like people to go on to my internet site, www.lonefathers.com.au, and have a look at my latest newsletter where I've said to every bloke, I've warned every bloke in Australia and the grandparents and that, we've got the laws now, they're there to be enforced. I've asked every one of them to just write a small note to their federal MP or even a state MP and say, I'm a voter too. If you don't stop this bloody rot that dads can't see their kids, then I'm not voting for you. And I guarantee you the laws will change overnight, mate. But I've said to the blokes also, if you don't do that, you don't take that minute to do that, then, you know, don't blame us groups who are fighting like buggery to change the laws if they overturn them, because there's a big push to overturn the shared care laws now in Australia too.
Oh, there really is, isn't there? I think we should talk about that because it's the major thing that's going on. No, there's a number of different inquiries, including one headed by the former family court judge Richard Chisholm and a number of others looking at the whole thing from the Institute of Feminist Studies, Family Studies. And,
I've spoke to Richard Chisholm. He actually asked me to work with him on this in a way, not to work on it. And I said to him, well, I can't really, because you was against shared care. Mm. You made it quite clear. He said, no, I'm not against shared care. We're only looking at where there's proven extreme violence. And I said to them, well, that's a different matter. And I also spoke to Jennifer McIntosh, who told me that she's upset because men are blaming her for trying to overturn the shared care laws. And she said, I'm not against shared care. She said, I'm actually pro-shared care. And I said, well, you've got to show that, you know. And but I also,
and you believed them?
Well, mate, I won't say what I believe on air. But I also went and had an appointment with the Attorney-General about it. And the Attorney-General said to me, well, you know, we're looking at only where there's violence. And I said, well, what do you term violence?
Oh, I know. They say that the party's in conflict, but the, proven by the very fact that they're in court and therefore shared parenting is inappropriate. Easy.
Yeah, well, I said to him, what I believe is where there's violence is when a person's been charged, convicted, charged and found guilty, not on mere allegations. And he said, but what do you, how can you get around that? I said, because if you started to bloody put perjury in where people blame people for these things and it's not true, and you start a bit of punishing them with perjury laws and that for lying to the court, we could get over all a lot of this crap, you know, but they're so naive in their own thinking, half of these politicians, that they don't want to do it, you know.
They're frightened of the woman vote. It's a simple, you know, to them, it's a simple piece of arithmetic, and whether or not, you know, adopting, say, a pro-father stance in family law would be a vote winner. And people like Albie Schultz, who has stood up, actually found his votes increasing as a result, and not decreasing as he might have feared.
Well, mate, I'm running a national conference in Parliament House on the 17th and 18th of March, and I haven't decided what I'm calling it yet. I was thinking of the second style and generation of children from dads, but I want to come with another name where something like where children are still being denied their natural rights by a country that preaches human rights, something like that. And I want to get a lot of people there because I think this could be the last one I ever run. I'm just about, you know, I've been doing this 36 years now, and I'm actually more disappointed in the blokes out there than I am with the law because, as I just said before, if everyone stood up and the grandparents and that who have got rights now too stood up and said enough's enough, we're not allowing this anymore, it would change. The worst thing you can say to a politician is you won't be getting my vote.
Well, as you know, we were critical. We didn't think, Dad's on the Air, our editorial line was that the Howard government had not gone far enough and that the laws were too easily overturned and that they should have just basically cemented it in concrete, that those family relationship centres should have been shared parenting centres, and that the sole function of the court should be to facilitate and encourage separating parents to cooperatively care for their kids after divorce, and just make it much stronger than it is.
I agree with you. But again, politicians can only pass the law. The Parliament can only pass. The family court is not, as McClellan, the Attorney General, tell you, they can't overrule the family court. They can't overrule the judge. The laws are there to be made. Now, they're, as I said earlier, we are getting a lot of positive stuff about shared care. There's a lot of blokes getting shared care.
Yeah, we were actually wrong on that issue. That in fact, there has been a sort of cultural shift towards it, hasn't there? There's been a public... We didn't think... We underestimated that.
And what I'm saying to these people is there is magistrates and judges out there doing the right thing, but at the same time, you've got these ones out there that just want to keep doing the wrong thing all the time. The culture has changed, as you said. Well, I take my hat off to John Howard, even though I believe it should have been mediation should have been compulsory, and they had to go, and those who didn't want to go, like mums or dads who didn't want to go, then they take their own chance, but I believe it should have been compulsory. That's where it's wrong. And but I know at least 90 people that's got shared care blokes, you know. Couldn't see that before. Now we're getting negative and positive emails about it, and we are probably bigger than all the other groups put together in Australia doing this by far. I'm here at my branches, you know.
Yeah.
They're getting positive stuff too. It's not just coming from Canberra. It's coming from around our branches, like one of my biggest branches in South Australia, and they're hearing about it, you know.
Yeah.
And they're seeing guys that struggle to even get access have got shared care now and stuff like that. So the culture's there and it's changed, but as I'm trying to get out to all these bloody blokes and their brothers, don't matter whether you haven't got family law or not, just say to the government, this is bull crap. If people want to break up and they're two good people, you know, they share the children whether they like it or not.
All right, you just stay there. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Barry Williams. He's the founder of the Loan Fathers Association in Australia and the grandfather of the fatherhood movement in Australia. We'll be back in a moment.
In distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Barry Williams, Loan Fathers Association founder. You're on the air, are you?
Yeah, mate.
Good on you. It's an honour to have you back on. We haven't had you on for ages.
It's all right. Yeah. My head's walking up the street, so it's pretty noisy.
Oh, you're on a mobile, are you?
Yeah, mate.
Oh, goodness. Well, hope for the best. Now, look, What, I know we're worrying him over this like a dog at a bone, really, but why do you think the Rudd government is, it just seems like a lunatic move to me to go into this whole arena of family law. I mean, why buy into such a hot argument, you know?
Yeah. I don't know, mate, I don't know, but I'm a bit disappointed. They told all us men's groups that we probably won't get any more funding, you know, like we used to get a bit of funding to run our offices, and the other government made us a national peak body, and they were funding us, and we got a bit of money through another scheme to run the office, and with the new government, they've told us there might not be that money there, and I've only got one person working 3.5 days a week, trying to help people, you know. I've never been paid. I've never had a day's wages in the 36 years. I refuse to have any, but I needed him. But now they tell me that they haven't got enough money to be able to give us. They've only got $240,000 has to go between six of us. Well, that wouldn't even pay the rent for the office, you know. If we've divided that, that's 50 grand or something, wouldn't even pay the rent for the office I got. But in the same breath, they've, in the same department, put out that they got $1.5 million and they want women to apply for it straight away and set up six women's coalitions because there's not enough women's coalitions. But then they can't find equal money to fund the men's groups. And this is what worries me.
This is the problem too, isn't it, with the whole debate. All the oxygen, all the funding, all the momentum, all the government backing, all goes to the women's groups. There's absolutely nothing to balance the ledger, is there?
Although I must admit, Jenny Macklin told me I wouldn't lose my funding. She gave me a promise I wouldn't lose my funding as a peak body. But, mate, out of that 50 grand I get for a peak body, I don't mind telling people because they think, you know, they should know. I've got to run nearly 20 branches out of that and give the branches some a little bit to help them go, you know, three or four, 500 each or something like that. It goes nowhere, but the insurance is just to run this organisation because we're an incorporated body, is bloody near 6,000 before we start, you know.
There's
nothing left out there and we're all volunteers. And I'm actually looking for sponsors for the Lone Fathers. I'm just hoping some of the big companies will hear this, and I'd like to, if they want to sponsor the, and we would put their name up and everything, that they're sponsoring something that it is for equality. We're not against women. We're not against men. We want a straight down the middle law that treats men and children as mums and dads. Even when they break up, they're still bloody parents to those children, and the children have that right, and I'll fight that to the day I die.
It is a really old-fashioned ideology which has permeated these things. You find amongst young women that they just seem a bit odd that it's not equal in family law, and that there is such bias, and they're all growing up, you know, with good educations and expect to be treated well in the workforce and expect to be treated equally in life, and just can't quite understand that we have these laws which really bash up on one gender.
It's really not their fault. It's the teachers they had to teach them that from their other parents. A lot of the extreme feminists just don't like men. They just feel that men are not necessary. That I've even heard them say children don't need fathers, you know. They only need a mother. And that's just selfishness, self-centred, and, you know, un-Australian. And that's the problem. And we're getting a lot of people now. We're getting Indigenous people. We're getting multicultural people who can't understand our laws, you know. They say, but this is ridiculous. You know, I was the main carer, especially people from the Middle East, and that I was the main carer of that in our family, you know. And this wouldn't happen in my country.
No.
But they soon find out, mate, when they come out here.
Well, from our experience doing this show, the Muslims, for example, just tend to avoid the whole family law process. You know, they just tend to avoid it. It's not in the culture. And, after a certain age, under a certain age, the children are with their mother, and over a certain age, they go with the father, and that's that.
That's right. Well, mate, we've got a lot to learn as a country, but we have a Family Law Act where the Parliament don't have the last say. They can, as I said before, they can make orders and that. They can't overrule any family court judge.
Mm.
I mean, you've got a, and as I touched on before, you've got what they call the Child Protection Unit, who take children away from, I've seen children taken away from parents by them, and the children were innocent. It was just that they were accused by another parent, and the child was taking them off. And I've seen a young girl taken away from her mother because her mother tried to protect her. She was 13-year-old going on 14, and she was meeting a 23-year-old bloke up at one of the shops, and her mother said, enough's enough. So the child-run child protection and child protection woman told her, you don't have to take notice to your mother on that. We will find you a place. They took the girl away from the mother. Mother fought them. They still took her away and they put her in this place. And with her in this home, there was another 18, 17-year-old bloke there or something. Mm. Within no time at all, the daughter was pregnant, had a baby. No one would help that young mother with the children.
Mm.
But her mother had to buy all the clothes and everything like that.
Right.
I went to Human Rights, and of course she had a case to be answered from taking the child away from her. And these young woman was there, she was about 19, and she said, we overrule any family court order. And then I checked that out, and I was horrified when the magistrate told me they do. They're 19 to 20-year-old, you know, are still bloody, just out of their bloody teens, and yet they're taking children away from families. It's just not right, mate. Just not right.
And then the politicians keep spending billions of dollars more on these, the Department of Community Services in New South Wales, of course, is always the heart of controversy.
Always the subject. But never mind, as I said before to everyone, don't think everything's bleak. The laws are better than they were. There's still a long way to go, though.
Yeah, I was thinking this, when you first started off in 72, you've seen the whole history of this. When you started off in 72, and the blokes that were coming to you must have been really sort of quite different types of blokes than they are now in some ways, do you think? You know, that the fathers of today are very involved with their children's lives and at the birth and all of that, you know.
Well, in them days, John, if you happened to win your children, you had to sort of virtually prove that you was a fit person, because they had what they called a child welfare then.
Mm.
And even when I won my case with my four children, and one was only 3 months old, I had the bloody child welfare turn up my door just out of the blue and said, they're taking my children. The only reason they said they're taking them was because of the male, and there's no other male in Australia rearing four children at the time, and it was never heard of them, so they had to take them, they said. And I fought them.
Mm.
And they actually rang the police, and the police come round and asked them, did I threaten them? And I said, well, if you're saying that I'm threatening them because I told them they didn't get off my front steps, I'd push them off. They were a couple of big ladies, you know.
Yes.
And I said, I guess I did. And they turned around and said, and what's your story to them?
Mm.
And they said, well, we want to take the children because he's a male and he can't possibly look after four young children. And I produced a court order from the Sydney court. And the magistrate, the judge said to me in Sydney, you're the first person under the 1975 Family Law Act that were on our books anywhere that would have been having custody of four small children. Look after your children, that's it. Mm. Wish me well. And yet these clowns come around there and try to take him. And so the police said, had a look at it, and they said, well, what's he done wrong? And they said, he hasn't done nothing wrong, but as we said, we're the welfare, we run this part of the law, and we're taking the children. And the two coppers turned around and said, if you don't get off his property, we'll lock yous up. So I won that round, and the case, you know, and...
Did they come back?
Oh... They kept ringing up and sticking their nose, and I just ignored them, you know. And the next minute, the Salvation Army lady come around, St. Vincent de Paul, wanting to help me out and that. And I said, look, I'm working. I'm, I've got someone looking after my young child while I'm at work. I was a transport driver around Canberra, and so I'm looking after my children. They're going, the older ones were 8 and 9. They're going to school.
Mm.
Their clothes are clean, everything like that. And I said, I don't want handouts because I'm earning a wage, you know, I'm trying to want to feed my own children, you know, just be a family like we were before their mother left. And that's how I ended up, mate. But I must admit, when I had an accident and I got hit in the head with a hunk of steel off the truck, there was no pension then for me.
Mm.
There was a supporting mum's benefit came in 1972.
Jeez, yeah.
And so I went on a hunger strike for 5 days and 5 nights to get it changed to the supporting parents benefit. Now, I can honestly say, even though I did that and I got it, and it was Fraser who agreed, Whitlam wouldn't, I've never been on the supporting parents benefit in my life. I chose to shoot wild ducks and kangaroos and trap rabbits to feed my kids for meat, and I was able to buy a bit of vegetables, you know. But it was a hard road, mate, but it's worth it. It's worth it to have your kids, I can tell you. I sometimes cry with some of these blokes when they ring up that they haven't been able to see their kids for 12 months, 2 years or something.
Oh,
I just know what it must be. You know, I can feel what they must be going through.
Oh, they're just totally heartbroken, aren't they? They're just...
Yeah, and I've seen good men, mate. And I will never forgive the governments for this. I've seen good men take their life through it, you know.
Yeah.
And I know I've been able to stop a lot of good men, just like Dad's in distress, Tony Miller does, and a lot of other guys. I know we play a major part in saving a lot of blokes' lives. I even saved a woman's life by this too. She couldn't see her children. So it doesn't only happen on one side. It does mainly happen to men, but there is the isolated woman, you know, that can't see her kids too.
Oh, I know. We had one woman on. She wrote a book, Our Stolen Generation, and she lost her kid after a 7-minute interview with a psych. And,
so I've got a lot of women in this organisation. We've got 30% women now, but they're women who want shared care. They want to share the children, and they're good women. They can't understand these other women that don't want to share the children, you know.
Oh, it's bloody ridiculous. It's hard work bringing up kids. Who wouldn't want a break? Why wouldn't you want to share all the trouble and the grief and the hard work? You know, it is. It's
John, I've had women. Well, I've had women now who are in a shared care situation who weren't before, and I've had women, honestly, have got in touch and said, this is great. Thanks for getting these shared care laws in. This is great because I have a bit of time to myself now. The dad sees the children, has the children, and we're getting on wonderful well, and our children are doing wonderful well at school. I can tell you a very sad story, and I'll have to go to them because my mobile's getting
late. Yeah, no worries.
This young girl is 5 year old. I know them. I know the child. I know the mother. I know the father. The mother fell in love with another bloke straight away at a barbecue.
Mm.
She left. And she didn't want the father to have the children, and the father fought, and they ended up having a shared care. While she got a new boyfriend, and the little girl was telling the mother that the new boyfriend was sexually assaulting her, she was just 5 year old, and pointing to the mother and telling her what to do, and the mother kept slapping her face, saying, you're only making this up. Your father probably put this in your head. And anyway, it went on, the father said, if you don't do something about him, I'm going to the court. She wouldn't do nothing about it. The girl used to cry her eyes out, you know. It must have hurt her. And her mother's own mother said to her, well, I know it. You know it's happening, your little daughter's telling you, and doing nothing about it. She said, so I'm no longer your mother, and I'll go to court, and I will stand up for the father because he's a better parent than you. And this is telling her own daughter, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, they found out the little child was being molested, and the mother still hasn't admitted it to this day, you know. So that's how sad it is out there for some of the poor little bloody kids, you know. And it's not usually the dad who gets accused. It's another man when there's sexually abuse on children. It's never, very seldom ever the dad.
This is true.
It's the second bloody boyfriends or something like that.
Oh, no, that's that's what the statistics
But anyway,
indicate.
Mate.
All right, we've been talking with Barry Williams, founder of Lone Fathers Association, the grandfather of the fatherhood movement in Australia. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
And I just wish all listeners a very happy new year.
A wild, wild night. All right, thank you, Barry, and all the best for 2010.
All the best to you and your family too, John. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. We'll be back.
Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same? Will it make it easier on you now? You got someone to blame. Leave a bad taste in your mouth. You act like you never had love, and you want me to go without. Well, it's too late tonight to drag the past out into the light. We're one, but we're not the same. We get to
so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
Dad's in Distress. 1-300-853-437.
We're back.
We were fortunate enough to record a number of interviews, presentations and workshops at the National Men's Health Conference held in Newcastle recently. One of those was by Greg Stock, who ran an excellent workshop on the Hey Dad programs for the facilitators dealing with the importance of restoring a dad's role in our society, especially in the Indigenous community, and for the great need to bring our dads back into the lives of our children in all of our communities, whether black, white or brindle. This workshop gives us all an idea of how dads are dealing with this all-important issue. So let's have a listen now to part two of the Hey Dads program.
There is this period here. Then we've got boys growing up who've never seen a role model as a father. They've had uncles and cousins around as well, but they're not getting good role models because they didn't have a father, because that father was out working on the land somewhere. And half the kids end up black in Sydney. So there's a chain that's been broken.
Right. I'm part way before that, 44, and then through to the 50s. What really happened was, in those times, parenting skills are handed down from father to son, from mother to daughter. What's happened there, now, after this, we've lost all those skills. This is my feeling on the whole thing. We've lost these skills, and what we're trying to do is teach mothers as well as fathers, not that there's other programs besides the Hey Dad, that these skills, and it's not just the Aboriginal people, it's the society on the whole. So what, we can talk about the 50s and everything, and there's a loss of identity, there's all those things, It's happened. You can't get away from it. But I think you see it's going right through the whole society, where they've lost those skills. Mothers aren't handed on. The Aboriginal people had it right because it took a whole village to raise a child. That was the premise we worked on. We've lost it. Now what we're trying to do, I think everyone in this room is doing exactly the same thing, we're trying to get that back. We're learning the skills to try and get those skills back to teach other people, mothers as well as fathers, the parenting skills they need to raise a kid in today's society.
And that's community capacity building, isn't it?
Yeah, big time.
There's a great challenge in your demographic there, though, isn't it? Because you look at the Indigenous population and there's a rebuild, but you've got a huge group of young people under the age of 30 and under the age of 25. So the time is now to grant those skills and pass the law. Well, we're going to lose that because the demographic's the opposite to the non-Indigenous population.
Well, I find it encouraging because I can talk from my community and I can talk from the education department side of things, where I see a change in young people. Young Aboriginal people are interested in their culture. They're trying to get it back. They want to know. They're hungry to learn. About their culture, and that's encouraging for me. But I'm talking about urban Aboriginal people. You go out in the bush, and it's a different story, isn't it? And it's got to come from the elders. You've got to have a really active elders group within your community to be able to start bringing these things back, because we've lost it. They made me an elder, and I said, what's an elder? Who's going to teach me to be an elder? Because I'm from Redford. No gum trees in Redford.
So you probably say it up the late 50s, early 60s, late 50s, 60s and early 70s, is that when the fall of community unity really took place?
Yeah.
And is that what should be written on that man's head?
Yeah.
Well, now what? it's completely stuffed up.
Community unity, isn't it? Is what drives that. You can't, on the mission, I'm talking from my mission's point of view today, come the Gunja. I remember and recall as a young boy the picket fences and the edges and the old red gum shacks, and I can recall being sent from house to house to get a tea bag or to get sugar or to get, and we just don't see that today, even on the mission now, that unity's gone, and where that unity was strong, you've got a lot of uncles and aunties and that big strong kinship structure that was there for the fall of the child,
Yeah.
So I think the a lot of work's got to be put around that unity, community unity, and building and restructuring the unity that we... That is in the pockets still, within our communities, but not right across like it was, as I said, in the 60s and 70s.
We're fighting each other.
Now, we turn a spear on each other quick, but...
How do we link those pockets?
Well, I think it's empowering the men again, you know, and it's ways of working out that empowering the men is where we'll really get to see the real community unity again.
How much of a man's role of being a father or a dad is part of that empowerment? How, if you were going to say 100% empowerment is due to such and such factors, where does being a dad go in that whole scheme of things?
Well, I think supporting the dad to be a good role, to be a good father, a good role model will definitely reflect, have a wider reflection on the community,
yeah.
Which will definitely strengthen the community, which the overall benefits of that will be unity. Yeah, men dependent on each other more, being more open with each other with health and physical downfalls that they may have, you know, stuff like that where that died away with the unity.
Even though there's a gap there of 60 years, there's a vacuum of skills and law, LORE, that hasn't had a chance to be passed down yet, but it's there somewhere.
There was a lot happened in that period from the 50s to now, not least out of Redfern in terms of the Census Act. And there was lots of changes that had to happen that were driven by a strong political movement coming out of the Aboriginal communities, Aboriginal youth, and was challenging traditions about, you know, how's about Aboriginal people get counted on the census? How's about we take out the floor and fauna act? How about they get the vote? You know, that was good. That was good.
There you go. I was over 1967. I was serving on submarines over in England.
Yeah.
And before that, I wasn't in the Navy. I wasn't an Australian citizen.
You're good enough to die for the
Navy. Shut our mouth, the Aboriginal people. There's only a few of us in there. Because there's no Aboriginal people in the Navy before 1967. Yeah. And the boat comes through. And that's when we were told, you know, we're Australian citizen. And that's the day I could say to the skipper, I'm Aboriginal.
And there was some optimism in the early 70s. You know, you had the Land Rights Act in the Northern Territory, and you had some changes having been driven in the community. But I wonder if how linked that is to the destruction of the unity, was there was a political movement happening in that. That had some, you know, history, if we look back, a history we don't learn enough about, there were big changes in
this. If you're running a group in a town, in a regional centre somewhere or a remote somewhere, how would a discussion like this help your men in the community? Would it? Touching on it, playing with it, not playing with it, but playing around with it.
Definitely.
How far do we go with that discussion and how far do we politicise it? Does it do the men in that community to keep dragging that anger up? Or is this just a way of naming it? Or should I go through that?
Well, they should own it. So they should own the timeline. They've got to know their history.
Yeah.
That's a glitch.
It's only a glitch in how long?
50,000 years. It's nothing.
It's nothing more than that.
So, I've never found it easier to teach someone things that they already know. I'm teaching a dad, whatever colour he, whatever culture he may be, about being a dad again. Really easy job, because it's in here.
I think I put those on that calico. You're helping people to deal with lots of those issues bit by bit.
Yeah.
They are inside their head, but they don't actually haven't got names for them. It takes time, weeks, months, to actually work through those.
Yep. And a HATAG group is, as I said, a therapy group. As a facilitator or a professional in your community, you should have in your back pocket where to send him. You can't do it in a group. You need to go and speak to so-and-so, a particular elder or someone in the community who can help you through this section of it. But I want to, if you could write down now, imagine this man. That's what's going on inside him. Jeez, it's not a nice place to be. You can actually feel that. There's a lot going on in there. Very, very confusing, very, very draining, very, very tiring. On the outside of that, our scribes, what does the community see? This man, he's suffering.
Anger?
What do they see? How do they see that?
Abuse.
Go for it.
Alcohol and drug abuse.
Go for it. What do you got?
No, it's the same abusive behaviour, but yeah, you know, what are you writing down these days?
I'm going to write alcohol and
alcohol.
A and D?
Yeah, that'll do fine.
Withdrawal.
Violence.
Violence. How does withdrawal work? Is that isolating himself?
Well, that's with the alcohol and drugs, it's the numbing. So we see the numbed.
There's a physical withdrawal and there's a psychological withdrawal as well.
Yeah.
And often people don't see there's two different things.
Mm.
So there's a physical walking away from, you know, that you're going to be outside the community.
Mm.
And there's also a mental thing too, where you're completely pissed up against the wall.
Yeah.
So there's the mental.
It's like a shutdown.
Mental shutdown. Withdrawal. How do they show the shame?
But they're shunned as well.
Oh, shunned. Sorry.
Shunned.
Shunned.
Suicide.
So they're ostracised in a way. Shunned, ostracised. Suicide.
Suicide.
What else is the community seeing out there?
Just the brokenness.
He's broken.
The family. Broken, yeah. The brokenness. The
loneliness.
It's like the aftermath, you know, that has happened, which is all the brokenness.
Mm. What else are they seeing?
A huge gap in certain ages of men, especially
out. Oh, okay, I was looking at one particular man, yeah, but he may not be there anymore. There's a gap in the 30s or 60-year age group, or 50-year age group, whatever you're thinking. So, demographic gaps. Is that a way to put it?
Yeah.
What about risk-taking?
Yeah, only on that.
Put that down there, buddy.
Mm.
And all sorts of health problems, too.
Yeah, health decreasing.
Health issues all over the place. You know,
right, what you want.
Problems, diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, diabetes. He put a few statistics up there this morning, didn't he?
Mm.
What was that? Tea, sugar,
apple tea, I think.
Flour, sugar, tea.
Diabetes.
Do not worry about his belly.
There you go.
That'll do. We know what it says. Diabetes, die.
Yeah,
that's what it says. What else is the community seeing about this man? How else is he behaving? What behaviour?
You'll get some men who are basically doing the work of 20 men.
Anger. Oh, okay. So
overburdened.
Overfunctioning. They have to.
But what do you mean? I reckon for most of the community, like I'm from Melbourne, so for all of the East and all of the North Shore of Sydney, they don't say it at all. These behaviours isolate them and they're invisible to most of the community and they're pretty happy with that. You don't see a lot of these fellas in the North Shore.
And that's a withdrawal.
You don't see a lot of these fellas in town. They're kept away in Redfern and because of the shame and loss. So most of the community don't see it and that's the way they like it.
So invisible.
They're invisible. And most of the governors are pretty happy with that. They don't want them. Who, you know, the community's out there, out of mind, out of sight, don't have to worry about it, we'll get on with it.
Well, if you want to go and disappear, there's plenty of communities disappearing, isn't there?
No,
they're
invisible.
In actual fact, the ones on the North Shore need more help than anyone, because it's the isolation from community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's the Aboriginal communities, the ones that are functioning, are close-knit.
Yeah.
You know, like out in the Warwick Peninsula.
But what's the figures? What, say from Sydney Harbour up to Central Coast is 800,000 people?
There's 30 on the Central Coast.
Let's say 2,500 in the north, 6,000 Indigenous in the Central Coast area?
Well, it's
out of, say, 800,000 people?
It's the third largest Aboriginal community in Australia.
Yeah. But I suppose, in Melbourne, you wander around South Yarra and Toorak, which is like, you don't see a lot of black fellas.
No.
Yeah, you wander around Kirribilli and, you know, Rose Bay. Yeah, for this is invisible for those people.
Yeah, well, that's
and they're happy about that.
Yeah,
you can go around Toorak, South Yarra, there's no, whether they're, not just black fellas either, you know, people suffering, that's a hidden problem, it's part of that mystique of it all too. It's an invisible issue for a lot of people and they like it that way.
Mm.
Okay.
Prison.
Yeah, crime, whatever you want to put down there.
Mm.
Now, when we do this, as I said, I've been doing it with training facilitators. Everyone's got something out about it. I just assume sometimes because we're professionals that we understand this stuff, but it's really good to see it down there about what's going on. What's happening for the man and what's society and community seeing. Then you leave. Now you're running a men's group.
probably going to have to spend the rest of the night on that, or you're going to have to go and sit down with someone, have a yarn with him, just to make sure he's okay with it. Because it's not therapeutic, hey Dad. It's not therapy. But this is naming something which is real in every community, for every man. Now, I've only got 20 minutes to go. Another thing I wanted to mention, I wanted to pick a few things out. Any questions on Lawson Group before I move on?
What can you do to counter afterwards?
Ah, thank you. You can finish it.
You what? No. Or are you sticking this, right?
That's a really good question, because I never know, I can't take them all home,
yeah,
but I offer them to the community who made them. So why not? So if anyone wants to take that today.
I sort of think I'd like to draw another picture of a man like that and get people to say, if this person met this person here, what would they want to do? How would they like to treat? How would you say to actually get the good stuff?
Actually, that's probably not a bad idea to do at the end of Hey Dad.
Mm. A step
away. Like a before and after, or in progress.
Well, isn't it at the same time?
Yeah.
Not, because they're not... When you do that, write that horrible stuff, now it's horrible stuff there. They're not... We aren't that.
Mm.
We aren't,
well, you do the aspirational stuff. Dad at the end. You know, what do you want to be? What do you think you can be?
Well, the good thing about doing that actually in a group of men is they can see some of it in there, but they know it's not all them.
No.
You know? They can see parts of it that... But they can also say, well, it's not me. We're talking about all of us here. So it's not personal when you're running an actual group. You're not, you know, everyone takes a little bit from it, from their own head and their own heart, but it's a group thing, and that keeps it safe. Because what we're doing when we're doing a Hey Dad, running a Hey Dad program, is we start wide. We don't ask about you. We don't ask about you. We don't ask about you. We ask about community, society. What does society think of 200 years ago, 1950s now? What are the societal norms? Then, when we do something like Lawson Group and Calico Man, it's still talking about any man.
It's a safer place to go.
It's a safer place to be. Then, with Hey Dad, we get out the photo language, for example, and we'll start asking them what, to pick a photo that means something about the father figure in their life. Then we start to bring it down to personal stuff. And we start to talk about them. And next week we come back and talk about parenting skills. But if you need to talk about this a little bit further, Unc's over here or, you know, something like that, let's make sure that is left safely. Loss and grief should always be left safely.
Very important.
But it's not all your job as a facilitator of a Hey Dad group. It's your responsibility to make sure that that person can get good help if you've opened it up.
Yeah.
You're listening to Greg Stock facilitating part two of the Hey Dad workshop. Don't go away. We'll be back after this break.
Well, my daddy went away and fought in World War II in the jungles of New Guinea, tried to see it through. Ended up with malaria and TB too. Got a little weaker each day. All the medals wouldn't pay for his lungs to be new, so they shipped him to a hospital to pull him through. The smoking didn't help, but he never knew the price that he'd have to pay. With his three little girls and his wife at his side, he worked with his hands and he beamed with pride. But when his oldest daughter got sick and died, he couldn't understand life that way. Then a son was born, and when I finally came, he was proud for me to carry on the family name. A home down on Botany Bay with his brothers and his friends after work each day. Cutting timber on the weekend till his lungs would ache. Worked a little harder each day. A little brother made it even, two girls and two boys. In this loving home, there was plenty of noise.
Daddy spent some time at the club with the boys while we grew more each day. Start a life of their own. My brother and me, we were still at home. Daddy was proud when the grandkids came, even though they couldn't carry on the family name. So I went off and found a girl of my own, moved away up north to start our own loving home. We had two girls and a boy of our own, been a family from that day. The kids are growing, got a life of their own, they'll go off and start their own loving home. My son's now a man and I'm here to say, I'll be proud for him to carry on the family name.
We're back with part two of the Hey Dad workshop, facilitated by Greg Stock.
In your therapy today, you talk about how you feel, provide some safety there rather than you deliberately done that, rather than your causes and your solutions and unpacking your individual story.
The good stuff does come out, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it does.
The individuals, you'll see, they open up something. It's extraordinary to watch, you know, at the end of it, after 6 weeks or whatever it is.
It's interesting, all the things
really,
you've got.
Really, really good stuff, you know, good self-esteem. You see them start to shine. You know, it's fantastic. And the person who's presenting it too, you know, it opens them up quite extraordinary.
That Calico Man, we only had, in a way, negatives.
Yeah, well, that's
but people actually don't always write that. They write, geez, he's strong. He's adapted. He's done this. He's done this. That's what's going on inside him, you know, in the communities. So not everyone just sees this as the behaviour. Sometimes they see, well, that man's actually risen. He's come out again.
Do you find that the workers are usually more negative than the participants?
It depends on the worker where they come from.
Workers are deficit based. They're always driven by funders. To look at the problems and fix them. So we.
That's why the training we do switches on light for so many people, because instead of looking at deficits and things that have got to be fixed, they go, hold it, this guy's already doing that. He's been doing it for years. He's been holding his family together for years. All we're trying to do is stop him drinking. But he only drinks on Friday and Saturday nights.
But you know, you talk to staff, you never look at clients. Clients are much more likely to go, why do you drink? Well, there's good reasons too. They might be bad. They'll say that, or they'll say that the joy in mental illness, not just the, not, you know what I mean? It's always staff, always. We're always super negative, just like we were then. We didn't have a single positive view. The strength it takes to survive, it's interesting.
I call it Lazarus syndrome. I'll let you use it if you want it.
Yeah.
Lazarus syndrome. You rise again out of the you know.
I just want to give you two little tastes of what we do in a Hey Dad and why it can be good for men in the community and how it can build their own personal capacity to build the community's capacity every block. Coaching. Funny term. But I tell you what, when we redesigned the program, the word discipline and authority was not wanted. We talk about authoritative parenting, but that word authority often doesn't go down well in the Indigenous community.
Why do people not like the word training, like coaching?
Well, it was originally called discipline.
Yeah.
And it's not as bad a word as punishment, but discipline's still a bit there. I mean, it does come from a Greek or Latin word, I think, disciple, to follow. So discipline's not a bad word. We're playing with words here.
It's still got a lot to do with power and control, isn't it? Mm. Which coaching takes away. It's not power and control. It's a guiding.
Myself, a Christian brother, with a big fat ladder of discipline, that's what it means to me. You get the shit out of it.
There's a part of the manual about the parenting triangle, about the least effective things at the top of the triangle. There's a couple in there, such as physical
abuse, physical punishment, those sort of things. Going down to the large part of the triangle, the pyramid, all those things that we put under coaching. Now, how do we get our men in our communities to start thinking about their kids and the job that they already are doing, even though they don't know it, do it, is to ask them, what other, think of a coach you had when you were growing up. Most of the people in the room would have played some sport at some stage. Not to be this room, but the men you're leading. They're probably still getting back into it again at a certain older age. And when I was at Wilcannia about a month ago, all four teams were in the grand final. Stupid time to run a group. But I can tell you what, they all identify with the word coaching. So I asked them, and I've sort of cut this fairly short today because we did a bit more on loss and grief, but that's so typical. What are some of the characteristics of a coach that you remember? Just some words, so don't you guys.
Leader?
What else? Characteristics?
Understanding.
Now you think back to your footy days?
Yeah.
Okay, think you've got someone in mind? Yeah. How else would you think your old coaches?
Mentors.
Jeez, mine were a bit more old school.
Yeah. Ruthless, brutal. See, 100 days.
Didn't know that,
I had to write them down because, you know, it's in your memory of the coach.
Yeah.
Positive.
Could do it myself.
Can I just write Dion White? Do you want to know what that means? He actually was not just a coach, but he actually played.
Yeah. Shocking strategy. Put me in the back pocket.
I should have kicked 6 points at half time. They banished me to the back pocket.
How long has he been sitting with you?
I think we've been playing that funny game now.
What else about our coaches?
Inspiration.
The way in medicine as well. If you like, for instance.
Dependable.
Oh, yes, the coach has got to be there on Tuesday nights. Because someone's got to turn the lights on.
Yeah.
Predictable. So,
yeah. You don't want that rigid.
But that's a good thing. Predictability is a good thing in
very
parenting good. And in well, yeah. You know what you're going
to
get.
Okay, can we now relate this to being dad?
Yeah.
Okay. Consistent. Predictable.
Yeah. Reliable. They're nice things in a coach.
Fun.
But what else does a coach do in a team? That's a big part of being dad. Teach, thank you. I was going to put this on two sheets of paper, but teach, yes. Of course they do. Coaches teach you how to pass a ball. He's got raw talent, but we need to help him kick on his right.
Hopefully they're fair.
Yes.
They're fair. Fair, what was the second part of that, Andrew?
Well, they share the positions around, so they're fair.
Yes, everyone gets a run.
Well, that's a bit of an extract from the Men's Health Conference and a group of Indigenous men there talking about loss and grief and all sorts of things. That's our final show, final Dads on the Air show for 2009. And what a year it was, good and bad. A lot of people had a fairly tough year.
I had a great year.
Of course you did.
2009 was a wonderful year for me, yeah.
Of course you did. It always counter to the prevailing trend, you can guarantee it. An independent character. Now, that was it for, as we said, the 29th of December 2009. Thanks to Barry William, the grandfather of the troubled Megan Australia.
We're dead on the air.